Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the crisis in Ukraine, the main instigator of which Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning is on the brink of civil war. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Piper, joins us to discuss whether talks between the U.S., Russian and Ukrainian foreign ministers scheduled in Geneva on Thursday will avert a shooting war and what the weak government in Kiev can do to reassure its citizens in the east to prevent further destabilization of the country by Russian political tourists and intelligence and paramilitary agents who have thoroughly infiltrated Ukraine's eastern provinces. Then we will speak with Joan Claybrook, the former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who wrote a joint letter with Clarence Ditlow, the executive director of the Center for Auto Safety, to GM CEO Mary Barra, saying that newly released GM documents are an obscure but smoking gun that, quoting, paint a tragic picture of the cost culture and cover-up at GM. We will discuss revelations in these internal GM documents that show the company considered, then rejected, a safer ignition switch in 2001, which they later in 2006 quietly provided as a replacement part after 32 crashes in which 13 people died. Then finally, we will look into former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg's $50 million challenge to the NRA aimed at the hearts and minds of America so that we can protect our children, protect innocent people from gun violence. Daniel Webster, a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, joins us to discuss the launch of Every Town for Gun Safety and whether it will curb gun violence in what Bloomberg notes is the only civilized country in the world that has this problem. Joining us now is Stephen Piper, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Piper.
Thank you for having me.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning Ukraine, warning that Ukraine is on the brink of civil war. This, of course, is a bit disingenuous since he's both being the arsonist and the fire brigade in destabilizing eastern Ukraine. What's your sense of how things are unfolding on the ground? There are conflicting reports of local people being offended by the Ukrainian military that's coming in. And there's also some reports of eastern Ukrainians being offended by the so-called political tourists coming in from Russia.
Yeah, well, you have a very difficult situation over the last 10 to 12 days in eastern Ukraine, where you've now had in about 8 or 10 cities and towns, armed people taking over police stations or city halls or regional administration buildings. I mean, on one point, there is some unease in eastern Ukraine about whether their political and economic interests are being fully represented by the acting government in Kyiv. I don't think anybody that's serious would deny that. But you've also, until these last 10 days, have not seen a big separatist push in the region. And it does look, when you see these various operations coming off in a very coordinated way, like there may be some instigation. And in this case, I tend to agree with what the Ukrainians say, which is that this has been organized by Moscow.
Well, there are reports of a Ukrainian soldier and an officer whose car broke down being held prisoners by pro-Russian Ukrainians or even Russians. Also, some of these armored vehicles apparently have been taken over by pro-Russians or Russians. It's difficult to know the distinction, right, between pro-Russian eastern Ukrainians and political tourists.
No, I think there has been that question, although the Ukrainians, I believe, actually had some success in reducing the number of what they call political tourists, Russians who cross the border and then go take part in demonstrations, in part because they've tightened up the controls at the border checkpoints when people come across. But of greater concern now is that when you look and you've seen a number of examples on the video, when you look at some of the people who seem to be in charge of these takeovers, they have a very professional military bearing. A lot of Ukrainians, they use the term little green men. This was the term that they used to refer to the people who were very professional in combat uniforms in Crimea who did not have any insignia to identify them. And what they're saying now in Kyiv is some of those little green men have appeared in eastern Ukraine.
So what's your sense then, Stephen Pfeiffer, of this brinksmanship? Obviously, Russia warned Ukraine or threatened them not to retaliate against the occupation of these government buildings by these so-called pro-Russian Eastern Ukrainians. And the government in Kyiv finally acted, and they've sent troops in. They've captured an airfield, but it's sort of doubtful about the success of the operation so far. And that's where we're at, right? I mean, this is really a tinderbox, isn't it?
I think the actions, which again, I believe have been inspired by Russian special services, really do put the acting government in Kyiv in a dilemma. Because on the one hand, they can try to reassert control. They can try to retake some of these buildings, which runs the risk of bloodshed. And that possibly creates a pretext which the Russians may be looking for broader action against Ukraine. And they still have reportedly 30 to 40,000 troops along the Ukrainian border. That's one option. The other option, though, is to stand back and do nothing and then watch this series of takeovers continue and in effect lose eastern Ukraine by a stealthy default. My impression is that the government has tried to be, has been restrained. I mean, it's tried to not have to use force, but they now may feel that they're in a position where they have no other choice.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kyiv, he had had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. So this meeting that's to take place in Geneva of the foreign ministers of the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine, that's at least a plus, isn't it? I mean, it seems so far that it's been the Kerry Lavrov show, and the Ukrainians don't even get a place at the table to discuss their own fate. So does this look like an improvement that the Ukrainian foreign minister will be in on those meetings?
That would be a positive development, and my sense is there's actually been quite a bit of sensitivity on the American side. They've not been comfortable talking about Ukraine with Foreign Minister Lavrov without Ukraine in the room. And my understanding is, in fact, that the U.S. government has made a lot of effort to be talking to the Ukrainian government before those meetings to make sure that they don't get crosswise with what Kyiv wants. But the meeting tomorrow, if it happens, there have been a couple of suggestions that the Russians at the end might not come, but at least as of today, Foreign Minister Lavrov says he is coming. It will be good because you have Ukraine at the table. And then the question is, can the meeting then begin to define a course that begins to diffuse and de-escalate the crisis and move towards more of a political dialogue? And a lot will depend on what Mr. Lavrov brings, whether he's prepared to take some steps that would, in fact, diffuse the crisis.
But Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, it seems, though, that using the analogy that Putin is both the arsonist and the fire brigade, it looks like there's another little fire starting in Transnistria, which is a Russian-dominated population-wise. I think 97% of the population in this little enclave in Moldova are Russians. And now they're sending a delegation to Moscow on Thursday. That all feels orchestrated, too. So is this what Putin's strategy is, just to continually to throw the Ukrainian government off base? And I take it he does not want this May 25th election to take place.
Yeah, I would focus. I'd be more concerned about what's transpiring now in eastern Ukraine. And again, no, you're right. If the Russians want to see the situation in Ukraine diffuse, they need to stop trying to destabilize it. And that is an important point. The May 25 election would be very important for Ukraine. It's an opportunity for there to be a new president who will have renewed democratic legitimacy, and that would remove some of the questions that hang over how the current acting government came into play. I think the current government came into play in a very understandable way politically, but probably did not check all the right constitutional boxes in terms of the formal removal of President Yanukovych, who basically abdicated when he fled the Capitol back on February 21. But that election would be very important in investing somebody with renewed democratic legitimacy. Ukraine knows how to do free and fair elections, but there is this question, do the Russians want to have that happen? The Russians have already talked about postponing the election. They would like to have constitutional change first. And my guess is that the Russians aren't eager to see that election come off, and they may find ways to try to derail that process.
But I don't know how much Putin is in an alternative universe. That was suggested by German Chancellor Angela Merkel after a long phone conversation. She thought that he was on another planet. But assuming that he's getting a broad input of advice from both the oligarchs and the military, and not just listening to his coterie of KGB cronies, the Russian people are in a totally alternative universe, aren't they? Their media is telling them the fascists and neo-Nazis and anti-Semites have taken over Ukraine and are persecuting Eastern pro-Russian Ukrainians in the East, and that's leading to this kind of war fever that's gripping the Russians. Even Medvedev the Prime Minister tweeted a remark about fascists and neo-Nazis taking over and the CIA director making a secret visit. What was that all about? What was John Brennan doing visiting, you know?
Well, I don't think we really have any information on what he was. I've seen one media report that suggested he was there to talk about ways that there could be enhanced communication with the Ukrainian government. You know, one of the issues I think that's been out there is over 20 years is the Ukrainian Security Service. It was never quite sure whether it actually had gone through the process to ensure that it was totally separate from Russian influence. But I think on the broader question here is, in Moscow, in Russia, there has been an extraordinary campaign on the Russian television to present a very, very negative narrative of what's gone on in Kyiv. And there are certain issues where the Russians, I think, have legitimate concerns. I mean, the Russians don't want to see ethnic Russians in Ukraine mistreated, but it's very difficult to find credible instances where that's happening. Some of the things that the Russians talk about, for example, about some diffusion or some decentralization of power in Ukraine, probably would make sense. I mean, right now, does it make sense for the president of the country in Ukraine to appoint governors as opposed to having them elected locally? And my guess is that the Ukrainian government would be prepared to meet some of those issues halfway. So there could be, if the Russians are prepared to find a solution tomorrow, you can look at questions like some decentralization of power, which the government of Kyiv has wanted to do. The Russians are very concerned, what kind of relationship there is between Ukraine and NATO. The acting government has said that NATO is off the table for now, which I think is a very smart decision on their part because NATO would be hugely controversial within Ukraine. So there are some areas where you could begin to see some convergence, if the Russians don't come in with maximalist demands. The Russians, for example, have suggested that the Ukrainian constitution ought to give the right to individual provinces to basically secede if they disagree with Kyiv. That's something that no part of Russia has. But if there's a more reasonable approach, you could see a way forward on these questions. But we're not going to know until Mr. Lavrov gets to Geneva tomorrow whether that kind of approach is going to be possible.
But on the issue that you mentioned of alleged persecution of Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East, even the United Nations has weighed in and said there's no evidence for that.
So exactly. But there was a concern. I think one of the acts on February 22nd, the Rada basically voted to overturn a 2010 law that had given Russian language special status. Now, we can debate the merits of whether or not that 2010 law made sense. I think, though, that the haste with which the Rada then moved to overturn that created concern in the East among some ethnic Russians and some Russian speakers. Are we now going to see an attempt to somehow restrict our language rights? Now, the acting president basically refused to sign the law into effect, so it never took effect. But I think this is a reflection, though, of perhaps a bigger question, which is when you look at the acting government in Kyiv, there aren't people there that the population in eastern Ukraine can point to and say, that person speaks for my political economic interests. Now, my understanding is that when they formed the government, they actually tried to bring in a couple members of the Party of Regions, which is primarily from eastern Ukraine, and the Party of Regions refused to join the government. So it's not strictly the government's fault that they don't have much representation from the east. But it's going to be, I think, very important for the government to reach out to the east and to signal that, you know, they're prepared to take account of the political and economic concerns there. It was a very good thing that Acting Prime Minister Yatsenyuk visited Donetsk last Friday. But the national leadership in Kyiv should be traveling to the eastern part of the country more to make them feel that the policies that are going to be conducted in Kyiv are an inclusive policy. And that may be one of the best ways to take the steam out of any support for these Russian-instigated actions that are going on.
But we were talking earlier about CIA Director John Brennan's trip to Kyiv and trying to figure out what that might have been about. And you mentioned the extent to which, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but the extent to which the Russian security services, the SVR, really have that whole country wired. I mean, it looks to me like Putin has people all across that country, doesn't he?
Well, I think the Russians pay a lot of attention to Ukraine, and I think that it has been certainly a target of their intelligence efforts for the last couple of decades.
So at this point, then, what's your sense, Ambassador Pfeiffer? You're offering up some suggestions of how there could be some moves on the part of the government in Kyiv to defuse stuff and to be more inclusive. And then you've got these foreign ministers meeting tomorrow. So far, the meetings of the foreign ministers have not yielded anything. I assume that the one assumption you can make, I take it, is that as long as they're talking, they're not going to be shooting, right? So shooting's not going to break out for at least another 48 hours. Would that be your reading?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's a tinderbox in eastern Ukraine, so I'm not sure you can guarantee that. But I think, again, the fact that they're meeting and they've got the right parties in the room is a good sign. The question is, will there be a chance to sort of explore some of these questions in a way that allows that meeting to begin to outline a path that gets to a dialogue that diffuses the crisis? And again, I'm just not sure, based on Russian actions and what the Russians have been saying for the last 2 weeks, that Mr. Lavrov, we just don't know what kind of approach he's going to come to the table with. And that seems to be the biggest factor that will determine the success or the failure of the meeting tomorrow.
But as far as Putin's concerned, being, you know, almost the absolute ruler, the new czar, so far things are working out incredibly well for him, are they not, politically? And at what point do you think there'll be a backlash or a wake-up call in terms of the long-term economic damage his move may be making to Russia's economy and its future and the future of its revenues coming from oil and gas? I mean, they are trying to pivot towards China, but at this point it looks as though all of his actions will lead the Europeans, who are dependent upon Russian gas in particular, to start looking for other markets.
Well, I think this is a very valid point, is that at this point in the Kremlin, they may feel that they're on a roll. But I think that there are unintended consequences that could come back to bite them. First of all, yesterday, the Russian finance minister revised the projection for Russia's GDP growth this year. He says 0.5%, but perhaps zero growth. That's down from an estimate 6 months ago of about 2 to 2.5% growth. There's an estimate that says that in the last 4 to 6 weeks, Russia's central bank has spent $25 billion to defend the ruble. And I've got to think that if you're an American or a European chief executive officer, now is not the time when you're going to your board of directors with a recommendation to make a major new investment in Russia. So, you know, there have been relatively modest sanctions applied by the United States and the European Union. Neither has declared a full-scale financial war on Russia, but the financial markets aren't waiting for that. They've already begun. So I think there's going to be an economic impact, which will be damaging to the Russian economy. We'll have to see if it has an impact on Mr. Putin's calculations or not. But I think there are other unintended consequences. I think Russia does run the risk of creating a large number of vehemently anti-Russian Ukrainians. because in the center of Ukraine, in West Ukraine, and even some parts of Eastern Ukraine, I think they see this as a Russian action that's designed to compromise their territorial, their integrity, their sovereignty. And so it's going to have, I think, a negative impact in much of Ukraine. And it's going to have a negative impact elsewhere. I mean, NATO right now is reexamining whether assumptions it made about NATO security are valid, given the very aggressive approach that you've seen the Russians take in Crimea and towards Ukraine. I expect one response is going to be that there will be a renewed decision by NATO to bolster the confidence of allies in the Baltics region and Central Europe. There have been some steps already taken, but I think there are going to be further steps basically to assure those allies of NATO's commitment to their security, but also to make clear to the Kremlin that there is a difference between eastern Ukraine and, say, Estonia, Latvia, Romania, which are members of the North Atlantic Alliance.
Well, Ambassador Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kyiv, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back with the former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who wrote a letter to GM's CEO Mary Barrick today talking about a smoking gun.